We have recently started going through my book, A Burning Desire, after 2 years on One Breath at a Time. And we're on the section called The Higher Power of Karma. And I'm on, and it's kind of, there are small kind of chunks that I'm taking on one class at a time. And I'm on page 24 for those who are interested, and I'm gonna look at my notes. Well, it starts with a quote. Actually, I want to look, see if I can find this article that this is taken from, where it says one of the hardest things to do is change the course of our karma. Zen teacher Bir Kern Judith Regeer calls it interrupting the karmic flow. And she calls it that in an article that was in the Inquiring Mind magazine. This is how prepared I am. I should have done this before, but it actually just occurred to me while I was meditating. Here it is. I'm going to give you a link to this issue of this magazine, which is now online. I was given the opportunity to be a guest editor of Inquiring Mind. I have to go and look at the date on it. So it was really a fun project. Says it was the spring of 2010. So that was around the time that Burning Desire came out. And there are a bunch of interesting articles in here. There's an interview with Martine Batchelor. I have a piece called The 12-Step Dharma. There's an article from Noah Levine, The Four Truths of Recovery, which was kind of the groundwork for refuge recovery. There's something called Selfaholics Anonymous, Santa Caro. An interview with Alan Marlatt. Vince Cullen has a piece. If you're interested, it's pretty cool. It was really fun to be involved in that. I'm looking for the article that I was looking for. And oddly enough, I don't see it. Oh, maybe I was hallucinating. No. Here it is. Practice down near the bottom, interrupting your karmic flow. So I'll just put a link just to this particular article in there too. The idea of this interrupting the karmic flow is kind of saying that we are very conditioned in our behaviors and in our thought processes and our emotional habits and all the stuff that, you know, makes up who we think we are. And it creates this kind of movement in our lives that's, if it's unacknowledged and we don't engage or try to change it, you know, our lives just keep flowing in that one direction, which, you know, as addicts, we know what that direction is, you know, down, down, down. And so we have to bring awareness and intentionality into the three forms of action, thoughts, words, and deeds, in order to change that flow, or else it'll just keep going in the same direction, right? And I mean, this is like preaching to the choir. You know, we all know what that's like, and how hard that is, and how much work that takes. You know, it's one of the things that always sort of made me skeptical of the idea that, like, God got me sober, or God got anybody sober, or God changed their lives. That when I see how much each of us does in order to change our lives. I guess this section is sort of about my own coming to terms with how karma works, you know, and sort of, you know, talking a little bit about the magical thinking that, you know, I was engaged in. And obviously, you know, when I write about these things, about my own experience, which is so much of sort of my approach to writing, it's with the assumption that my own experience is not unique, that it's somewhat generic, at least for someone with similar issues, you know. Just to talk a little bit about, you know, the magical thinking, right? I mean, there's the, you know, sitting at the end of the bar, telling people about all the great things you're going to do in your life, which is really kind of the most crude form of magical thinking, because it's not even really, you know, trying to do anything. It's just talking about it. But, you know, for me, like when I got involved in Buddhism, you know, when I first got involved in Buddhism, I wasn't sober, and I had this idea that somehow just by meditating, all my problems were going to be fixed. And I had no real conception of this process of change. And that's where, thankfully, you know, encountering AA, in my case, 12-step work, really taught me the fundamentals of change, of how to live. And, you know, the first aspect of that is showing up, which is, again, in terms of karma, that's the essential thing. You have to do the thing. You have to show up to do the thing that you want to change. You know, that no amount of meditating or praying or hoping, waiting for the phone to ring is going to make things happen. We have to take action. You know, so, you know, I tell the story about being sober and thinking about going back to school, you know, and which was, you know, a radical for me in a lot of ways, because I'd had such a horrible time in high school. You know, that was when I started to encounter depression and started to drink and use, and you know, I dropped out, and really, you know, behind that was this sense that I kind of hate school, and I'm not really, I don't know if there was a thought that I wasn't smart enough for school, but it was kind of like wasn't smart in that way or whatever, you know, just ideas, right? We get these ideas about ourselves, especially, you know, when we're young and encounter difficulties. So, you know, finally I kind of came to this idea, well, I could go back to school, you know, and then I said to my sponsor, yeah, but, you know, that would take me 4 years to get a degree. And he looked at me and said, well, you know, in 4 years, you're going to be 4 years older, and you can be somebody who has a degree or not. And it just was like one of those, you know, how dumb am I kind of thoughts, like, again, I'm sort of putting myself down, but I mean, just that kind of realization that I didn't know how to live. You know, I didn't know about showing up and about, like, working towards a goal for me, it was like, oh, well, I tried once. So if that thing I wanted didn't happen, you know, like I would make a demo tape of a band and I would send out the demo tape to one record company. And I, you know, 6 months later, I'd get a rejection and I'd be like, oh, okay, I guess that's not meant to be, you know, this really helpless sort of attitude, like just no understanding of persistence and showing up. And I don't know. I don't think that's unique. I also don't think that every alcoholic has that particular version of not understanding karma. But I think each of us does have our own understanding, our delusional understanding of how to make our lives better. Like I need to, you know, the geographic, right? Or I need to stop drinking wine and start drinking beer, you know, the things that are in the AA big book. Or, you know, I need to get away from this person, you know, I need a divorce, that'll fix me. I need to quit my job, you know, these kind of things when we're not looking at the real process of causality, what's going on. And so we could say, you know, that's sort of not taking responsibility, which is, again, sort of a fundamental addict tendency, you know? I mean, the idea that I'm going to manage my emotions and my life by being loaded is clearly an irresponsible choice in the first place. So there's, sorry. Phone buzzing. So this kind of coming understand, I think, I imagine many of you went through this. I certainly saw it in my early years of recovery with the people that I kind of got sober with, you know, my classmates, if you will, that we kind of learned how to live. And that's what sponsors, besides helping us go through the steps, were really kind of helping us with, these very simple things, you know, and some, probably a lot of you have heard of the Pacific Group in LA, and which that's where I got sober in LA, and not part of the Pacific Group. But somebody was just talking to me about it the other day, and because it's known as this super rigid program. There's a guy named Clancy who started it. I don't even know if he's around anymore, but where, you know, men aren't allowed to have facial hair and they have to wear a coat and tie to meetings and things like that. But my understanding is that, you know, it really started, and Clancy started working with a lot of men who were just had no idea how to function in the world, like had to learn basic hygiene, you know. And, you know, and that's not for me, thankfully. I had that one. But it really just points to how many of us really needed pretty basic life skills. We had to learn pretty basic life skills, which, again, coming back to this topic of karma, were the things that were going to determine how our lives unfolded. And again, like our magical thinking was like, oh, that's not the way, you know, getting up in the morning and taking a shower and going to work, that's not going to do anything. What I really need to do is get loaded and write the next great American novel. You know, then, you know, as soon as I become a rock star, then everything's going to be cool. Like, yeah, but I don't want to go to rehearsal today because it's like, I'm too hungover. You know, so it's that simplicity, you know, and it always felt to me like, you know, the things that I was learning were just so basic and simple that I don't know if there was some resistance on some level, like it can't be that easy, or that's for lame people who aren't really who don't have big creative ideas, you know, people that are going to be like rock stars like me, you know, okay, you know, you need to have a job and all that stuff. That's for lame people. But, you know, I'm busy, you know, working to conceive my first three albums, you know, that'll never get made. So another piece of this, which I talk about here, is another piece of the magical thinking, and I kind of mentioned this, but this was really important for me. I'll read this part. Magical thinking expects instant results, but real change rarely happens this way. It's more the steady drip drip of accumulating acts. My attitude had always been that if something didn't work out right away, it wasn't meant to be. But this goes directly against Buddhist teachings, which is that nothing is meant to be. Nothing is fated or inevitable in our lives, beyond, of course, sickness, old age, and death. In terms of what happens to us as we live, none of it is preordained. Just because something is difficult doesn't mean it's not meant to happen. It doesn't mean that you have to stick with every single thing you try. It does mean that when we say everything happens for a reason, we don't mean that there is some being up in the sky deciding how things should be, but rather everything happens as a result of intentional actions. So this is how we interrupt the karmic flow, through actions. But before we make those actions, we need to see what should be done. And this takes the wisdom that comes out of mindfulness. When we pay attention with a clear mind, we begin to get an idea of what needs to change in our lives. Once we see this clearly, we make a plan and act on it. So, I'll read the rest of this. It goes into particular thing. One way to support this is making vows. Traditional vows are more religious in nature, but the 12-step tradition gives us another form, just for today. When we make a vow about showing up and following through on our intentions just for today, we make tasks that may seem unachievable, like getting a college degree, manageable, cutting them up into more reasonable pieces. Just for today, I will show up for class, we might say, or just for today, I will go to work or my meeting or do my meditation. Interrupting the karmic flow takes mindfulness, intention, and action. If we want to change and grow, if we want happiness and satisfaction in our lives, we must find ways to follow through on what's really important to us. And I'll say that my recollection, I haven't read this article, Judith's article, in some time, but my recollection is that it kind of focuses on, I'm looking at it, she focuses on steps 4 through 9 as kind of like the what she says, the steps are specifically directed at untangling karma. And so the steps 4 through 9 are about that. You know, step 4, one way of characterizing it. And so if you don't recall the steps exactly, step 4 is we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. So one way to characterize this in Buddhist terms is that step 4 is a reflection on how our karma has been created, that we go back through our lives and see the karmic flow. And that's the beginning of unraveling it, because the first thing we have to see in order to change our karma is, what is it? You know, what have I been doing? How have I been living? How do I think? What are my beliefs? How do I act on those? And then what has been the result of acting on those beliefs? And then, of course, we have to question the beliefs. Step 7 is always kind of my point of sort of humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. You know, if we take God out of the equation there means that we have to take action on those tendencies, on those habits, on that conditioning, on that karma. And, you know, and the first thing we have to do is address the beliefs and the thoughts, the mental habits that are behind the actions, and question them. And part of that can be done internally. Part of that can be done through meditation. Part of it can be done through therapy. I find that a really helpful thing, because there's this person there who's kind of mirroring back to me, what am I saying? And sort of helping me to question my beliefs. And part of it's with sponsors and sponsees as well. And, you know, friends. And I don't think it's something that is so helpful to think of as just doing alone. That's part of it. But the problem with trying to do this totally alone is that, you know, you're trying to fix the problem with the thing that created the problem. It's kind of, Einstein has some line about that, right? So we realize, like, my thinking is kind of screwed up. I need to change my thinking. What should I think? Well, wait, you know, who's going to, you know, how am I going to know? And so it's important to get external help on that. And part of that external help can just be study, right? Sometimes you're reading something and it hits you and you go, oh, right. Or that Dharma talk. Oh, that's pointing exactly to what I do. That really helps me to see. So there are many ways that we can work at this process. And it's not, as I was saying during the guided meditation, it's not something where we arrive at, okay, I've got that solved. You know, the underlying tendencies, you know, seem to be things that are maybe to some extent actually in our DNA, but they are kind of our karmic DNA in any case. And so that for certain things can be uprooted, though, that we just don't act on them anymore. We don't have those thought patterns anymore, the emotional patterns anymore. But certain things are like, oh, you know, my companion for life, my self-hatred or whatever. And how am I going to interact with, how am I going to relate to this companion that keeps showing up even though I don't like it? And I mean, probably, you know, if you've ever had one of those friends that, you know, I guess they call them frenemies nowadays in the modern, the kids go, you know, people that like somehow they're in your life and somehow you just kind of connect with them. And even though like they're kind of a pain in the ass, I don't know how many of you watch My Brilliant Friend, but that relationship in there, right, is kind of like that. It's like, yes, and it's a little bit like Linu and Leela, you know, that, you know, there's like a love hate. And so we have those, you know, our brilliant friend inside, you know, that we live with and that we have to reconcile. You know, we have to find a way to not be in conflict, because it's like something maybe that we don't like about ourselves, you know, and yet it doesn't go away. You know? And how do we like not be in conflict with that aspect of ourselves? You know, of course, for many of us, especially as we're aging, there's that relationship to our body that we don't like. And you know, we can't really trade that one in. You know, it's not like we're going to cut off our, you know, I'm not talking to you anymore. It's like, oh, okay. But, you know, in the it's still there. And so how we live with that, what is our relationship to our body? It's a whole other, we could do a whole other book on that topic. So I'm glad I got going today, because I wasn't really in the mood this morning. So got myself churned up enough to have fun. So I hope that was a little helpful. I'm sort of in this relationship with this book now, just as an aside. Now we'll just put this into parentheses at the end, brackets, that I'm not sure how much I want to be like going through this book. And that's part of what's kind of why I say I wasn't so much in the mood, but that was okay. Somebody is saying hi, who's this is their first time with us. I have been struggling so much with the AA meetings in my community. I am sorry. That can be so difficult. You know, it's such a tricky thing, especially if we feel like I need it, but I'm not comfortable in it. And there's no doubt, like the different communities, when you say community, different areas, different meetings have different cultures. You know, and I was talking about how recently I got to hang out with a lot of the people who were there when I got sober in 1985 in Venice Beach. And they have an alum meeting now. And I saw how the culture, I was reminded of how the culture of that meeting really fit me and why it worked so well for me. But it was definitely distinctive. You know, I've been to many, many different meetings, and particularly, you know, I got sober in LA and then I moved to the Bay Area, and the cultures were so different, the AA culture. And I also spent 2 years in grad school in Orange County, which culture was also very different. And surprisingly, you know, for somebody who's a Northern Californian, Orange County, I found that meetings there are great. It was very program oriented, very service oriented, also, you know, very God oriented, which, you know, you have to hold in whatever way works for you. But I think it's also worth, going to different meetings and checking out, trying to find different cultural sort of settings to see where you fit in. Not if you're really alienated by a particular group, to just try another group. It's one solution. So, oh, look at that. Suggestions. Boozers and bathrobes. Wow. It's from Santa Fe. Santa Fe, so beautiful. That's great. Thank you for folks for being supportive. Also, just to mention that I have not been mentioning lately, probably much at all, but that we do have a and it's up. It's in the chat that we have a little contact list where people put in whatever information they want to put in. It's, you know, very much personal how much, but people put in, some people put in their phone numbers and email addresses and maybe a little bit about their background. And so there's some communication, as I don't know, people don't tell me, but I assume that goes on amongst people in this group that to support each other, which is really, really a good thing. I hope that's happening. This idea of like blending Buddhism and recovery is, as you know, like a very small subculture. And so we definitely need each other. It's, for me, it's the thing that, I find the most joy for the last couple decades, and particularly in regards to my recovery. It's the place where I feel I can be most fully myself. And, I can go to any AA meeting and be okay with that, but it doesn't feel like all of me is necessarily there. Just, you know, as I say, that's okay, but it's nice to have a place where I can feel more fully myself. So I haven't left much time, but if anybody wants to chime in, say anything, please unmute yourself or raise your hand or whatever you like. Mary Helen, please.
So I've been wanting to share this. It's kind of a strange example of the usefulness that I've found out of meditation. But about 2 weeks ago, I had to have my first MRI, and I wasn't entirely sure that I would not be claustrophobic. The more I heard about what a strange experience this was, someone planted the idea that, oh, I just go in there and close my eyes and do my meditation. That combined with something you said about, you know, when a strong emotion comes up, like fear, for instance, turning toward that rather than trying to suppress it. Those two ideas carried me through that experience. And I actually used the gata that Thich Nhat Hanh suggested. And you have repeated, and I so appreciated that, because the thought in this strange environment of Thich Nhat Hanh, who has passed away, when I got to the point of pleasant present moment, wonderful moment, made me smile, and it got me through the whole 20 minutes. So, it's a small example. I won't have to do that very often, but it was 20 minutes of strange meditation.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that. You know, it's very interesting that you arrived at the gata, because the one time when I did an MRI, I did the exact same thing. Although I found, because I'm also, you know, claustrophobic, which I blame on my brother rolling me up on carpets when I was a small child. But in any case, subjected to, you know, such things when you're the youngest of five boys. But I actually arrived at, I think I just worked with, you know, I was kind of going through them, and then I was like, deep, slow. Deep, slow, deep, slow. I just stayed on deep, slow for most of the time, because I needed something to really, like, get me calm. So that's a good tip for all those who are, you know, maybe get to have that wonderful experience of being in a tube. what else? We have a retreat coming up. I think maybe there's a flyer that was in the, I think Monica put the flyer in there. May 10th to the 15th, right? May 15th to the 12th. I better click on the flyer. Anyway, it's in May.
15th through the 20th.
There you go. Thank you. Good thing I have other people around, because, you know. So 5-day, we call it Buddhism recovery, but it's a lot of meditation. So if you've never been on a meditation retreat at all, and you're thinking you're going to come to a thing that's going to be all AA meetings, you'll be disappointed. We have one meeting each evening, but most of the day is spent in silence, sitting and walking meditation with some Qigong and a workshop and a talk. There's enough happens, but if you're not used to it, it doesn't seem like anything's happening. Yeah, Steve.
I've been curious to ask this question for a few weeks now. The more I read the Eightfold Path of Bhikkhu Bodhi, I'm curious, what stage of jhana do you feel that you're at right now?
Well, one isn't supposed to talk about attainments in meditation, but It's not a question of being at a stage, really. Jhanic, being in the jhanas is something that just comes and goes. It only can happen when meditating. It's not possible, as far as I know. Even I don't think the Buddha even could be in jhanas unless he was sitting still. For most people, it only happens on retreat, on an extended retreat, or in the aftermath of an extended retreat.
That explains a lot, because I find it confusing sometimes when I go through those and I read, how do I interpret that, in the teachings? And so you just clarified a few things with me in that statement. And so that's very beneficial, very, very helpful. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's not something that, like, you just sit down and go, oh, I should be in the jhana. It's like, no, that's the experiences I had that. The thing is, so for people who don't know what we're talking about, jhana, J-H-A-N-A, is a translated as meditative absorption. And they're really altered states of concentration. They're deep states of concentration. And historically, there has been a great deal of debate within the Buddhist world about them, about should you do them? And what are they? And there is no agreement across Buddhist traditions or across Buddhist teachers about it. I did for quite a few years work with a teacher who taught an approach which some people discount as not authentic jhana. So it becomes really like talking about it gets into just sort of becomes somewhat of a mess. But the whatever concentration states I got into only occurred on at least a 10-day and more likely a month-long retreat. And then, as I say, sometimes in the aftermath, that I could carry that on for some weeks or maybe months if I was very rigorous in my practice. But the thing about the jhanas is they're very seductive, and maybe more so for people who have been drawn to altered states through substances. And so we can get this idea like, oh, I want to have that experience, but there's no intrinsic value in getting into the jhanas. They are only a tool for developing concentration, and out of that, developing insight. As experiences themselves, they are lovely, but they don't solve anything.
Well, that was incredibly helpful. I'm glad I asked the question. Thank you. It really helped me a lot to understand what that writing's about, that teaching. Yeah. It was confusing to me. Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, good. Well, thanks for asking. You should never wait to ask a question or, do what you must. So nice to see everyone. Thanks for continuing to show up and interrupt your karmic flow. So keep it going, keep it flowing.